Okay, good morning once again as we enter into round three. It's a pleasure to introduce Rabbi Berman, who, for those who didn't hear him over Shabbos at Or Chaim or last night or this morning already, he's spoken. So it's really a pleasure to have him. We had met once before very briefly, a number of years ago, when he was in Toronto running a Yarchei Kala. But now he was here over Shabbos. I missed him over Shabbos, actually, even though he was in my neighborhood. I have a bar mitzvah here. But anyways, I heard he was wonderful, and you'll hear he's very articulate and clear. He a graduate of Princeton University. He learned in Harishon a total 8 years, I believe. 2 years before college and 6 years after college. He got smich in Israel, of course. He got a PhD in Bible. He teaches at Bar Ilan. In Bible, he has written a number of books. He's working now on a book on the social revolution the Bible introduced into the world. He's a fellow, the Shalem Center, which is a very well-known, I guess you call it, a think tank in Israel. And it's a pleasure to have him here in Toronto, and we will let him speak now on the meaning of a covenant, of a brit.
She's her hands up?
Yep.
This is a very moving moment for me, because the topic that I'm going to speak on this morning, moving to this afternoon, is a topic that I've dedicated the last 3.5 years of my life to working on in the context of a book that Rabbi Kelman spoke about. And this is my first opportunity to share some of these ideas with other B'nai Torah. And I think that these are ideas that are vastly important and unknown. And so you are my guinea pigs. We will see if you find these important, irrelevant,
louder.
Or outright kira. I hope not the last, and I really don't think the last. But to head that off, let me give the following introduction. I'd like all of us to think about a piyut, which we're all familiar with from our tefillah on Yom Kippur, where just before Slichas, we say, Anu banecha ve'ata avinu. We are your children, you are our father. And that kind of anthropomorphism of making a Kadosh Baruch Hu into a father is a way in which the Torah and in which Chazal have always used such imagery so that we can relate to what it means to have a relationship with a Kadosh Baruch Hu, who obviously is not a father and doesn't have seed or anything like that. And the type of anthropomorphism of Anu Banecha, the Ata Avinu, doesn't bother us because we understand that it's meant to be a metaphor, and we're happy for that metaphor because it helps us get a grasp on what a Kadosh Baruch Hu is looking for from us. And so we say, Anu Banecha, the Ata Avinu, Anu Rayatecha, the Ata Dodenu. We are your lover, and you are our beloved. That also helps us relate to a Kadosh Baruch Hu, because we all understand and appreciate the power of a love relationship between man and woman, and therefore that helps us get in touch with perhaps another aspect of our relationship with a Kadosh Baruch Hu. These two metaphors of Ata Avinu, Ata Dodenu, are powerful precisely because they are familiar to us. But in that same piyut, we have other images which are not familiar to us. When we say in that same piyut, Anu Tzonecha, the Ata Ro'enu, we are your sheep, and you are our shepherd, I don't think there's anybody here in Toronto, certainly not in this weather, who's tending sheep. And if you've ever gone in Israel and hung out with a shepherd or had a shepherd come talk to you, then you realize just how much you're missing. When we say this type of image, that we are your flock and you are our shepherd, when you understand the various manifold tasks that a shepherd engages in with his sheep. And because we're not familiar with shepherds and sheep, we're missing a little bit of what Chazal had in mind when they included this passage, this line in the piyut, Anu tzonecha v'ata ro'enu. Or when they say in that same piyut, Anu karmecha v'ata notrenu, we are your vineyard, you are our scarecrow, watcher over the vineyard. I don't even have any idea what that means. I don't know, a vineyard is where they grow grapes. Clearly, those who live in a culture where there are vineyards and where there are shomrim, where there are people guarding over the vineyard, are much more clued in to what the Paitan wanted to tell us about our relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu than we urbanites are. And it's to our loss that we don't understand some of these images. In just the same way as the piyut introduces metaphors to help us grasp our relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu that we perhaps don't get fully in touch with, it is my claim that we have the same issue when we come to nothing less than Chumash itself. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu tells us that he has entered into a brit with us. Brit. What is brit? Covenant. What is covenant? Brit. Something a little circular about that. In fact, if you look in the Oxford English Dictionary, they don't even know how to translate covenant. It's gone out of use. Really, that's what it says there. And what I want to try to get in touch with this morning is, what does this mean exactly, brit? Because it's a metaphor. It's taken from a real life situation. And only if we understand that real life situation will we really understand fully what the Torah meant by telling us that a Kadosh Baruch Hu has entered into us in the context of a brit. Now, let me just say, well, some people might say it seems, I don't know, kind of like a pact, a treaty, an agreement. But it's really unlike, and it should be very obvious, unlike any types of agreements that we today enter into. Any agreement, any contract that we sign today, we sign as equal partners. If I'm selling you my house, then if we sign, it's because both of us have agreed to enter into this. Or a car, or a place of work. All agreements between states today are agreements of parity. You have two equal parties. When both parties are interested in the terms that have been agreed upon, they enter in. And if they're not interested in the terms, then they won't enter into the agreement. And it's very clear that the brit of Har Sinai is not that way. It's not as though Moshe Rabbeinu read the Torah to Am Yisrael, the Sefer HaBrit that's referred there in Shmot Chaf Daled, and Bnei Yisrael said, well, you know, could we change this? Or we don't like that. Or we don't want the whole thing. That seems to have not been an option. And so all the agreements, pacts, treaties, contracts that we are aware of in terms of our own daily experience are clearly not the paradigm that the Torah is working off of when it introduces the concept of brit. If we think that perhaps brit is something that's forced upon you, if you think, I don't know, Lahavdil, the way in which the Nazis entered France and they set up the Vichy government and said, this is what you're going to do, and you have no choice. Well, that doesn't seem to be an appropriate model either. It's true we don't have much choice about Torah, and yet it doesn't seem to be forceful. It's true, because I'll speak about Kafalei Amhar Kigigit, but there seems to be much more reciprocity and a relationship, and so the idea of terms that are imposed upon us by force of a Kadosh Baruch Hu also doesn't seem to fully explain what we mean by this concept of brit. So what is a brit? What was it back then? Just as the Paitan understood vineyards when he said Anu karmecha va'ata notrenu, just as he understood sheep and shepherding when he said Anu tzonecha va'ata ro'enu, I want to get at today, what was way back when, in the time of the Tanakh, what was the meaning of a brit, and how might that help us understand our relationship with a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Now, I want to say that I'm going to say my conclusion already at the start. There is something that's going on in other cultures called a brit, and the Torah has borrowed from that. This should not scandalize us. We are already familiar with the Rambam's position about korbanot, that the Rambam says that the Torah
commanded korbanot because that was what other cultures did. There are things that the Torah imports from other cultures. What I'm going to say today is far less daring than the Rambam's position of korbanot, because what I'm going to say is that there was just something common in the mindset of people living in that age, whether they were from Israel or whether they were from other countries. And the Torah used what was part of the common mindset. Divra Torah kilashon b'nei Adam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Torah speaking to the people of that time in terms that they can understand without any pejorative connotation. And I hope we'll be able to see the imagery that he was invoking, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was invoking in using the language of Brit, is actually a very evocative and powerful way of understanding our relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. And if we don't understand the ancient Near Eastern context, it's to our loss spiritually. This is not an exercise in academia here. I am giving this as a sheer Torah. Brit. Well, let's look at a couple of Britot. Clearly, if the Kadosh Baruch Hu is entering into a Brit, then we need to investigate perhaps a little bit about what Brit means elsewhere in the Torah. So if you look on the first side of the source sheet that I've given here, so we can see that Brit is, in its most natural, original setting, a political arrangement. A political arrangement between two powers. Let's look. There are many places. I'm just going to show here two of them. Here we have in Bereishit Lamed Aleph when Yaakov is fleeing from Laban, and then Laban catches up to Yaakov, and he says, Laban says, source, the first source here, "V'ata lecha nichrata brit ani v'ata v'haya le'ed b'ni u'b'necha." Let's make a brit. And then they set it up. Yikach Yaakov Eben v'armeh ma'seva. He makes a little stone to commemorate the brit. Then skipping on, I mean, I've already skipped the next pasuk Nun. We have the terms of the treaty. Laban says, "Im te'aneh et benotai, if you deny them basic sustenance, v'im tikach nashim al benotai, or if you take additional wives, ein ish imanu re'eh Elohim ed b'niu v'necha." Then that will constitute breach of the brit. V'yomer Laban Yaakov, "Hinei agal hazeh, hinei ma'seva she'ariti b'niu v'necha, ed agal hazeh, v'eda ma'seva im ani lo evor elecha, et agal hazeh, im ata lo tavor elai et agal hazeh." Each of us will stay in their own turf, their own territory. So here we see one example of many where brit is a political arrangement between two parties. Another example, let's look in the next source from Malachim Aleph. And this speaks here of a good king in Yehuda named Asa. ויתנם ביד עבדה וישלחם המלך עשה אל בן הדד בן תברימון בן חזיון מלך ארם היושב בדמשק לימור. The backdrop for this is that the king of Yehuda, Asa, who's mentioned here, is in a state of near civil war with Melech Yisrael at the time, a figure by the name of Baasha. The names are not so important. This figure, Asa, looking to garner outside help, looks to make a deal, a contract, an arrangement with a foreign power, the Melech Damesek. And so he sends all this tribute, gold and silver, and this is what he says, Pasuk Yutet. Brit b'ni u'b'necha, ben avi u'ben avicha, hine shalachti lecha shochar keset v'zahav lecha feira et britchad basha melech Yisrael v'yaleh me'alai. I want to pay you off, I want to make a brit, that's the lashon that's used here, a political arrangement between me and you, you being the Melech Damesek, and I want you, Melech Damesek, to fight against Melech Yisrael. Pretty sad state of affairs when Jews have to join up with outside elements to gang up against other Jews. But be it as it may, my point here is simply that a brit is always a political treaty. The question is, what is our brit? What is the nature of our brit with the Kadosh Baruch Hu? You see, when we say that brit means a political treaty, it turns out that there are many types of britot throughout the Torah, throughout the Tanakh. The brit that we saw in the first source seems to be a parity treaty. Not parity, like to make fun of. Parity, right? Of equals. Laban and Yaakov, if they both agree, they enter into the brit. They both don't agree, or one of them doesn't agree, there'll be no brit. The same thing with the second source. Asa is proposing terms to Melech Damesek. If he wants, if both of them want, they'll enter into the brit. If they don't want, they won't enter into the brit. We have some britot in the Torah which seem to be not two-sided at all, but just outright gifts. For example, brit ben haveterim. it reads in the Devarim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu asks nothing of Avraham Avinu. He just says, here, the land is yours. So brit can mean many different things. That brit, for example, brit bin Abitarim, in terms of the political mindset of the ancient Near East, is what is called a land grant, meaning kings would sometimes reward their most faithful subjects by saying, look, you're loyal to me, I appreciate what you've done for me, I want to continue to have a relationship with you, and as a reward, here, I'm giving you a parcel of land. And Avraham Avinu, who's the most faithful subject of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, is zocheh to receive what the Torah there calls a brit, even though nothing is requested of him. And there's no negotiation and there's no two sides. So we know that generally, just to sum up to this point, that brit seems to be based on what different powers, usually kings, would do to one another in making arrangements with each other. What type of brit is brit Sinai? Now, we have, when I say we, I mean the scholarly community, we have at our disposal lots and lots of finds, archaeological finds, from all over the Near East. Lots and lots of treaties that are written out in full form that describe how states related to one another. And it turns out that there is a remarkable similarity between many of the terms that the Torah uses to describe the brit between a Kadosh Baruch Hu and Am Yisrael and a certain set of treaties that were found in the Hittite kingdom, which is in southern Turkey, around the time of Yetziat Mitzrayim. I want to be very careful about what my claim is here. My claim is not that a Kadosh Baruch Hu or Moshe Rabbeinu ran up to Turkey, opened up these treaties, copied out of them, and then gave us the Torah. My claim is that because treaties by their nature are international, that this evidence, which we happen to have dug up in southern Turkey, is reflective of mindsets that were very common and de rigueur throughout the ancient Near East. As I like to say, I breathe fresh air. Yasser Arafat breathed fresh air. The fact that he breathed fresh air doesn't make it wrong for me to breathe fresh air. So the fact that we find certain terminology used amongst idolatrous people, these Hittites were total of the Avodah Zarah. But the fact that they thought about relationships between kings, between nations, in a certain way, is probably reflective of ways in which all the nations of the ancient Near East, including Israel, thought at the time. And if HaKadosh Baruch Hu dibra Torah kelashon b'nei Adam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to b'nei Israel in terms that they could relate to, then it shouldn't be too far-fetched to say that the lashon of brit that HaKadosh Baruch Hu uses in the Torah, that we find echoes of what this brit, what it's about, what does it mean, what are its constituent parts, that we find this in the international relations of other cultures. Okay, that's going to be my premise here. What we find in these Hittite treaties is the following. We find britot, we find treaties that are different than anything that we've mentioned so far. They're not parity treaties between two kings, both of which are strong, and they wish to make some deal that both will agree to. It's not that. It's not a treaty where one party is very strong and imposes his will on a minority party, on a minor party. It's not that. It's something in the middle. And this is what it is. You have a situation where a neighbor of the Hittite kingdom is in Shtuch, Soros. Soros could be one of many things. It could be a famine. And the king of that neighboring state writes to the Hittite king and says, I'm in Shtuch, I have a famine here, we're all starving. And the Hittite king sends along bushels of wheat and other food, thereby saving this weaker neighbor. In the wake of that chesed, which is effectively what it is, that the Hittite king has done for that neighbor, the neighbor then comes back and says, okay, now I want to enter into, with you, a brit, a special type of brit, called a vassal treaty. We enter into this not as equals. You are sovereign. I am subordinate. But because I owe you a debt of gratitude for the Yeshua that you did to me, I am now prepared to be loyal and faithful to you in ways basically that you will determine. Another example of a type of vassal treaty, it could be that a neighboring country, a neighboring state, is about to be gobbled up by a third state. And so this neighboring state turns to the Hittite king and says, help! I'm about to be gobbled up. Come and save me. And the Hittite king sends his forces and saves this neighboring state. And then in the wake of that, this neighboring state turns to the Hittite king and says, I want to set up this vassal treaty that is by definition of unequals. You are sovereign and I am subordinate. Okay? Now, what turns out is that a lot of those treaties, we have, I don't know, about 20 or 25 different examples of them from southern Turkey. It turns out that they have a very standard set form. And that standard set form is remarkably illustrative of what the Torah does when it lays out the ideas and the mitzvot of Greek in the Torah itself. I want to go through step by step what the typical elements were of this type of Hittite treaty, and then try to show how that's illustrative of what's happening in the Torah. Every single one of these treaties that we have begins with an introduction. An introduction of the history between the two states, between the Hittite king and the Yeshua that he did for the lesser party. That explains why these two powers are coming into relationship with one another. It essentially comes to lay out what the chesed was that the stronger king did for the lesser king. Now, if we just come to Chumash itself, then we can see this, I think, pretty easily. All of these all of these treaties start with a very standard formula. These are the words of, enter the name of the Hittite king, and this is the favor that he did. Right? These are the words of the Hittite king, and these, this is the favor that he did. Well, how do the Aseret HaDibrot open up? Vayedaber Elohim et kol hadvarim ha'ele le'mor, right? You have the name of the stronger king, and an announcement of the chesed. Anochi Hashem Elokecha asher hoseiticha mi'eretz Mitzrayim mi'beit avadim. You know, if you think about it, that's a really redundant phrase there in Perek Chaf, in Sefer Shmot. I mean, after 15 prakim of Yitziat Mitzrayim, you would think that it would not be necessary to remind Bnei Yisrael that he had taken them out of Mitzrayim. But this is formal treaty talk. These are the terms of the treaty. I am the sovereign king, and we are entering into this treaty of unequals, of a superior and a subordinate in the formal way. Dibra Torah Kalashon Bnei Adam. I am the king. This is the chesed that I did for you. I took you out of Mitzrayim. This already, I think, is very illustrative of something. Our loyalty and allegiance to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not because he's the Borei Olam, because he is strong. Our allegiance to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a debt of gratitude. What animates all of these Hittite treaties is the idea of chesed done by the stronger party and the gratitude, the debt of gratitude, owed by the minority party. Our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is one eternal, long debt of gratitude for Yetziat Mitzrayim. In the Hittite treaties, after the introduction that lays out what the backdrop was, what the chesed was that the stronger king did for the lesser king, the next element, the next part of the treaty are the stipulations. That is to say, what constitutes acts of loyalty that the subordinate party must commit to for the good of the stronger party. Now, in those treaties, it's, you know, all the things you might imagine. If the stronger party is attacked, then the weaker one has to come to his rescue. If the younger part, the smaller party, the weaker party, learns of some seditious attempts in his kingdom to overthrow the stronger king, then he has to apprehend the seditious parties. Well, what do we have now here in the Aseret HaDibrot? Loyalty. Where do we see that? Pasuk Bet. Anochi Hashem Elokecha asher hoseiticha mi'eretz Mitzrayim mi'beit avadim. Lo yelech Elohim acharim al panai. The Hittite treaties all start with, you're loyal to me? That's exclusive. Me and nobody else. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying the same thing. If you're going to be loyal to me, you don't be loyal to anybody else. And this, again, I'm bringing this because I believe that there are Ruchani lessons from this. Because we might have always understood this pasuk. Why is it that the Torah says, Lo yelech Elokim acharim al panai? Because they're false gods. Because the Kaddish Baruch Hu wants to teach us truth, and truth is to him and not to anybody else. That is true, but there's another element to it. And that is that the Kaddish Baruch Hu is forging a relationship with us. Loyalty to me is exclusive. If you show loyalty to other gods, then it's like you're cheating on me. In fact, those familiar with the Lashon, Lo yelecha Elokim achirim al panai. Al panai, this in Sefer Devarim, speaks there of multiple wives, and you take another wife, al panai. It's just like it's lashon that's used in marriage in certain places. There's exclusivity in marriage, loyalty to a single spouse, a single partner, and therefore other gods. Not just that they're false; it's that there's a betrayal, there's ingratitude if you worship other gods. And so the demand for full loyalty, you have it in the Hittite treaties, and you have it here as well. Let's have a look here in the same source from the Aseret HaDibrot. In Pasuk Hey, Otze Chesed Alafim Le'ohavai U'Leshomei Mitzvotai. What does that mean, Ohavai? Those that love me. You know, we have a mitzvah, the Hasat Hashem Elokecha. What does it mean, Ohavai? Well, it turns out that many of these treaties from the ancient Near East, kings speak about loving one another. What does that mean, that kings love one another? It turns out, and this is also verifiable within the lexicon of Tanakh itself, that ohev in many instances does not mean rapture and emotion and connection. Ohev means loyalty, to be loyal to. Look, for example, in the next source, the next Hebrew source from Malachim Aleph. It speaks here about the relationship between Chiram Melech Tzor and David HaMelech. Says here, "Vayishlach Chiram Melech Tzor et Avadav el Shlomo," when Shlomo was beginning to build the Beit Hamikdash. "Ki shama ki oto mashchu lemelech tachat avihu, ki ohev haya Chiram leDavid kol hayamin." Now, what does that mean? That Chiram loved David all the days? They were close bridge partners. What does that mean? That they, I don't know, carried on romantically? Chalil v'chas. What does it mean? Ohev here clearly means loyal. Loyal. When one king displays loyalty to another, and David was the stronger king, and Chiram was the weaker king at that time, then Chiram was always ohev, he was loyal to David. And you see this here in the English source. I mean, it's not English, it's actually Ugaritic, or something like that. From the Elamarna letters, let's see what it says. It's referring here a letter written by the king of Byblos, which today is sort of the coast of Lebanon, and he was a smaller kingdom, the king of Byblos, and he's writing to the king of Egypt, to the Pharaoh, who was a stronger king. And he writes, "Behold the city of Byblos, where I live. Half of it loves the sons of this guy, who are rebelling against you. Half of it loves my lord." Now, what does love here mean? Again, it means nothing more than loyalty and fealty. And the king of Byblos is talking about, "I love you. Read, I am loyal to you. And this other group in the city are fostering rebellion. They are loyal to, they love somebody else." And so therefore when Kadosh Baruch Hu says, going back to the Aseret HaDibrot, Otze Chesed Alafim Le'ohavai U'Leshomei Mitzvotai. Ohavai means those who are loyal to me, those who carry out the mitzvot. There are other places in the ancient Near Eastern literature where the favorite subordinate king, in other words, if there's a strong king, and he has treaties with many smaller parties, because he can have treaties with many people, right? It's only the weak parties that have to show full alliance, full loyalty to the sovereign king. If you have a sovereign king and he's got a treaty with this little guy over here, and this little guy over here, that little guy over there, the way in which the favorite little guy is referred to is he is called...
Do we have hair markers?
No?
Have I checked hair markers?
No, not that I know.
Okay, we'll do with that. I think we can do without. We'll do without.
The way in which the favorite subordinate power, the favorite vassal, is referred to is...
This better come off.
Yeah,
or I'll be in real trouble. Oh, cool. Good thing I'm leaving tonight.
It's called these are the letters. Does that say anything? Sigula, right? With a T at the end. The favorite weaker party of a given king, a mighty king, is called the Sigula. And this is what the Kodesh Baruch Hu says about Am Yisrael in the source here from Shmot Yudchet. V'ata im shamoa tishmu bekoli u'shmartem et briti v'item li sigula mi kol ha'amim. You'll be my favorite subordinate party from all of the amim. And it's taken directly from Treaty Talk. Now, many of these treaties speak about how once this relationship is formed between the sovereign party and the subordinate party, on the backdrop of the chesed that the stronger party had done for the subordinate party, there's a long list of demands of what the subordinate party now owes by way of fealty and loyalty to the stronger party, and the Torah gives us many mitzvot. But these treaties also lay out what the stronger party will do for the subordinate party when there is a need for help. And so too, a Kadosh Baruch Hu promises us in many places in Chumash that he will protect us. He will grant us food if we're loyal to him. He will protect us from our enemies if we're loyal to him, exactly as superior kings do to inferior kings. Okay? Okay. So the first standard element of these treaties, these Hittite treaties, was an introduction that gives the background, the historical background of the chesed that was done from the stronger to the weaker party. The second part of these treaties universally is the stipulations, the chiyuvim, the obligations that are made upon the weaker party to demonstrate exclusive loyalty to the master king, to the sovereign king. And then comes the next part. The next part is that the treaty is written down. It's written down, so it's very clear what the obligations are for both sides. And then these Hittite treaties universally demand that the subordinate party take the tablets on which the treaty is written and deposit them into his own temple. You know what I'm saying? Right? The weaker party has to take a copy of the treaty, go home, open up his mikdash, as it were, and put it in there, as if to say, this is the holiest thing to me. This is binding. Even my gods in my temple here are going to sign on to this. Okay? Now, this on the one hand is carried through in Chumash, and in another way is revamped to fit the ideology of Chumash. We see, from Shmot Perichatei, what happens to the copy of the treaty, as it were, the luchos that Moshe Rabbeinu receives, v'natata et hakaporet al ha'aron milamala, ve'el ha'aron titen et ha'edut asher b'nenecha. You need to put the edut, which is a synonym for the luchos that Moshe is going to receive, you need to put them into your mikdash. So it's exactly the same thing, with the following difference, of course. In the Hittite context, what's happening is that the subordinate power has to show that the treaty is really dear to me, and my local god is going to sign on to it. Here, of course, the mikdash that we put the luchot into is the mikdash of the sovereign king himself. But the idea is the same. It was plainly obvious to Moshe Rabbeinu and probably to many members of Bnei Israel, when you make a treaty, a brit, with a sovereign king, and you are the subordinate king, then you have to treat the brit seriously, and you do that, you show its prominence by putting it inside your mikdash. The next part of another thing that I think is really quite illuminating. What happens in ancient Near Eastern states when the tablets upon which the brit is written get destroyed? Right? That happens. They fall, right? Or they get effaced or burnt or something like that. So let's look here in this source at the bottom of page 1 in English. Treaty between, I can't even pronounce this. We'll just read what it says here. Now what's happening here is that you have an address from a sovereign king to the subordinate king. And he says, my father made a treaty tablet for, this is you. In other words, he's speaking to him in third person. He's basically, my father made a treaty tablet for you. Right, that you were going to be my subordinate, I was going to be your sovereign, and it laid out all the chiyuvim that you had towards me. But the tablet has been stolen. I, the great king, have written another tablet for him, meaning for you, have sealed it with my seal, and have given it to him, meaning to you. In other words, when you have a treaty between the two parties, there always has to be written proof of it. Well, this is enormously illuminating, because what happens in Torah? What happens in Torah is that the original treaty tablets get broken. Moshe Rabbeinu got upset. And so it's not enough to then patch things together. You got to write the treaty tablets anew. And that's what we have, the top source on the next page. when they make the treaty again, so you have to make new tablets. Ve'yomer Hashem Moshe, Solcha Shnei Luchot Avanim Karishonim V'Chatzatir HaLuchot HaTzorim Asher Hayu Al HaLuchot HaRishonim Asher Shibarta. So you have the introduction of the Chesed, you have the stipulations that the sovereign king demands from the subordinate, you have the obligation to place the treaty, tablets of the treaty, into the central shrine, the sanctuary of the subordinate party. The next standard part of these Hittite treaties is witnesses. Who are witnesses? The gods. Enormous pantheons of gods. More gods than you could possibly ever imagine. The storm god and the sun god and the river god. All these gods are going to be witnesses to this treaty. That is to say, if you dare to breach the treaty, then you should know you're going to run afoul of this god and this god and this god and this god. Well, we have the same thing, but of course changed for ideological purposes. Here in Dvarim Perek Dalet, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has entered into treaty with Am Yisrael, and he says, Ha'idoti v'chem hayom et ha'shamayim v'ha'aretz. I am also calling witnesses. Now, of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not going to call the sun god and the storm god and the river god, because they don't exist. Right? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu instead calls on elements that are eternal, things in nature, shamayim v'aretz. So elements of nature in place of all these gods are called in as witnesses. You have it in the next source too, in Dvarim Perek Lamed. Haidoti v'chem ayom et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz ha-chayim v'amavet natati defanecha ha-bracha v'akol v'achad v'achayim l'man tichya ata v'zarecha. You have it in Ha-Zinu. You have this also in Yishayahu. Chazon Yishayahu ben Amos Asher Chazal Yehuda v'Yerushalayim Yimei Uziyahu Yotam Achaz Yechizkiyahu Malchei Yehuda Shim'u Shamayim V'azini Eretz. Yishayahu calls out the Nevuah that he gets from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he calls upon Shamayim V'aretz to be witnesses. Ki Hashem Diber Bamin Gidalti V'romamti V'hem Pashubi. And now they're going to get their comeuppance, they're going to get their punishment. But I have the Shamayim V'aretz as witnesses because they were there, the Shamayim V'aretz, when the Greek was first entered into. They were the internal witnesses that HaKadosh Baruch Hu called upon. The next element that's in all of these Hittite treaties, we've sort of done this already, is that in addition to witnesses, right, after you have the introduction of the Chesed, and then you have the stipulations, and then you have the requirement to deposit the treaty into the temple, and then you have these witnesses, oy oy oy, oy vavoy, if you don't listen to what you're supposed to, we have curses. Extensive curses to the subordinate king if he doesn't follow what he's supposed to do. You know, may the sun god torch your earth. May the storm god bring drought and famine. May the pestilence god bring pestilence, etc., etc. It's really quite colorful. You should see these curses that they have. And you can see already that some of the last several psukim that we've read also invoke these types of curses. And in fact, we have very long lists of klalot in the Tochacha, in Vayikra Chavav, and the Dvarim Katchet. These are all patterned after the ancient Near Eastern treaties between sovereign kings and their subordinate kings. Now, everything that I didn't bring this, but for homework, we're not finishing, but just homework in the meantime, you can read Yehoshua Perek Chaf Dalet. Yehoshua Perek Chaf Dalet is sort of Yehoshua's valedictory speech. And you will see how the outline that I've given you here of an historical introduction of Chesed done, of stipulations required of the subordinate king, of witnesses, of writing down the treaty. They're all there, element by element, in Yehoshua Perek Chaf Dalet. Because what Yehoshua is doing at the end of Perek Chaf Dalet, you know, you might think, why does Yehoshua have to reenact the Brit? I mean, we had a Brit at Sinai, isn't that forever? So what happens is this. What you see in a lot of these ancient Near Eastern treaties is that, let's say you have two kings that enter into this type of relationship, the sovereign and the subordinate. In the next generation, either the sovereign has passed on and his son has taken over, or the subordinate has passed on and his son has taken over, you see that routinely they do chidush habrit. They establish a new brit, as if to say, the personnel have changed, but let's just make sure that we all understand that the terms of the brit are the same. And so when Yehoshua is passing on, he's now not going to be a representative of Bnei Yisrael. Bnei Yisrael themselves have changed. Those that stood at Har Sinai are no longer. And so he feels the need to say, as we're moving on into the next stage of history, we're going to go through a whole treaty enactment that all of you will understand, you meaning the people living at the time, all of you will understand, many of you will understand, is patterned after the way in which treaties are made between sovereign kings, here, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and subordinate kings, us, B'nai Israel. And again, the key thing that I think that comes out of all this is that the primary element in these ancient Near Eastern treaties is the need for a debt of gratitude. That if someone has done me a good, then I owe him eternally. And I think that's a really important part of our relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Our relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu is not just because he's true or because he's powerful, but because he did for us a chesed. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Asher Hoceticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Now, there are some smaller aspects in these ancient Near Eastern treaties, these Hittite treaties, which are not standard elements in all of them, but are nonetheless, I think, illuminating of certain mitzvot that the Torah gives us. Look, for example, at this source that I have in English here, treaty between Tud Haliyah, Tu of Hatti, and whatever that means. Okay? Now, what we have here, the king of Hatti, the Hittite king, he's the sovereign king. And this other guy, Sunashura, he's the subordinate king. And what's being outlined here is the requirement of the subordinate king to come and visit the superior sovereign king periodically as a show of deference. And this is what he says. Sunashura, meaning the subordinate king, must come before his majesty. That's this Tud Haliyah guy, the sovereign king. Sunashura must come before his majesty and look upon the face of his majesty. Kind of a strange phrase. You have to come and look upon the face of me, his majesty. As soon as he comes before his majesty, the noblemen of his majesty will rise from their seats. No one will remain seated above him. This is very important because it demonstrates that the subordinate king is not some type of schlumpf. It's not that he's brought in tar and feathered. He is given great kavod because the relationship is an amicable one. Yes, the sovereign king did a great chesed for the subordinate king, but the subordinate king and the sovereign have entered into an amicable relationship of mutual respect, unequal, but still mutual respect. And so when the subordinate king comes to visit on a regular basis, the superior king is welcomed as an esteemed and honored guest. See, even the nobleman of the sovereign king will have to rise when the subordinate king comes. Now, look carefully at the first line of this source. Said the Shunashura must come before his majesty and look upon the face. Look upon the face of his majesty. That phrase in Hebrew is lirot p'nei. Lirot p'nei. And I'd like to look at some sources from Chumash to see what the term means, lirot et p'nei. Like, for example, we have here in Bereishit Mem Gimel, when Yehuda was begging Yosef to release Binyamin. And it says, "Vayomer lav Yehuda lemor ha'ed he'id banu ha'ish lemor." Yehuda is reporting here to Yaakov, "Lo tir'u panai bilti achichem itchem." Yosef, or he didn't know he was Yosef, but the viceroy of Egypt told us, "Lo tir'u panai," you will not see my face. In other words, it would appear that lirot panai is not just here. I see you. You see me. Lirot panai apparently is a term that reflects visiting a king. When I visit a great king, I see his face. And Yehuda is saying to Yaakov here, this viceroy in Egypt told us, "Lo tir'u panai," you will not see my face. You will not have visitation rights in the court. You will not be able to get an appointment with the viceroy. Lo tir'u panai. We have the same thing at the end of Makat Choshech in Shmot Perek Yud. Paro gets fed up and says, "Vayomer Paro, lech mi'alai, I've had enough. Tishamer lecha, al tosef re'ot panai. Don't come back to my throne room. Don't have an official visit with the king. Lo, al tosef re'ot panai. Ki biyom re'ot panai tamot." Not just the next time you see my face dermatologically when you're able to, you know, optically see my frontin, but it's the next time that you come to the court, then that will be your last day. Vayomer Moshe ken dibarta. I'm not going to make another visit to this court. And in fact, that's what happens, right? Makat Bechorot, Moshe doesn't visit until Paro comes begging for him to come and visit. Now, Now, oh, I can't believe I left this out. The most important topic. Why have I brought all this?
Because three times in the Torah says, Shalosh pa'amim b'shana, three times a year, Shalosh pa'amim b'shana, yere'e kol zchorcha et p'nei ha'adom Elohei Yisrael, three times a year, you have to come on pilgrimage to the Mikdash. Shalosh pa'amim b'shana, yere'e kol zchorcha et p'nei ha'adom Elohei Yisrael, v'lo yir'u panai rekam, and you shall not see my face empty-handed. In other words, you have to bring certain types of korbanot. But it's very clear what the Torah is saying. What the Torah is saying is that when we go on Aliyat Regel to the Mikdash, Lo Yeru Panai Rekam, it's taking from tree language. It's a visit of a subordinate king, i.e., each and every one of us, in our visit before the superior king, the sovereign king, just like this Shulma Shura guy. And it's a visit in which we're welcomed as esteemed guests, subordinate, but esteemed. It's a visit to our treaty partner who is sovereign. We're about to bring that pasuk. It's in Shmos Lamedalev, and I think it's in Zvarim Tezayin, and one other place. I can find it for you afterwards. I apologize for reading it a lot. Now, what's really interesting about this is that when we say that a Kadosh Baruch Hu made a brit with Am Yisrael, and we say that it's patterned after ancient Near Eastern treaties between superior kings, sovereign kings, and subordinate kings. Let's do the conversion. What's happening in Brit Sinai? Who's the sovereign king? That's easy. That's a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Who is the subordinate king? Is it Moshe? It's not Moshe. The Brit is not with Moshe. Moshe is a representative, maybe. Maybe it's Am Yisrael. Maybe the subordinate king is the collective of Am Yisrael. But look at this last example that we just saw. Three times a year, we have to do what we call Aliyat Regel. And the Torah has phrased Aliyat Regel in the terms of a subordinate king visiting a superior king. Put differently, the subordinate king might not just be the collective of Am Yisrael, but each and every one of us is a subordinate king. HaKadosh Baruch Hu looks to us with great kavod. Not to say, the kavod is not equal. The kavod that we owe him is much greater. But we are mechubadim when we come and visit HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Each and every member of Klal Yisrael is a subordinate king. It's not a coincidence that the Aseret HaDibrot, do you know what all those Dibrot have in common? They're all phrased L'Lashon Yechidim. There are no collective mitzvot there. There's no mitzvah in the Aseret HaDibrot to wipe out a Malek, to set up a Sanhedrin, to build a Beit HaMikdash. All those are mitzvot that are given to the collective of Yisrael. But the basic treaty stipulations of Aseret HaDibrot are aimed at me and you and you and you. Each of those mitzvot are things that the individual can execute, because each of us has the status of an esteemed, although minor, subordinate king. Just let me finish up and I'll take some questions. Okay. Great. We have just a little bit more left to do. Look at this next little element that I have here in English. This doesn't appear in all the treaties, but in, I think, three or four of them. And again, you have the king of Hatti here, the Hittite king. He's the sovereign. And this guy, Aleksandru of Wolusa, sounds Polish, I don't know, is the subordinate king. And this is what the sovereign says to the subordinate. Furthermore, this tablet, which I have made for you, Aleksandru, shall be read out before you three times yearly. And you, Aleksandru, shall know it. In other words, we're writing down this tablet, this treaty, all the stipulations. You have to do chazara. You have to know what it is that you're meant to do. How are you going to be a faithful treaty partner if you don't know, if you haven't memorized, if you haven't internalized the treaty stipulations? Well, this is what we have here. Look in Shmot Chatzalat and Mamad HaSinai. It's not that Moshe comes and says, folks, Ribono Shalom wants a brit. You're in. No. He reads to them the treaty stipulations. Vayavo Moshe, Vayisaper la'am et kol divrei Hashem et kol ha-mishpatim, Vayam kol ha'am kol echad ve'yomu, kol ha-dvrim asher diber Hashem na'aseh. And then finally we'll skip the Pasuk Zayin. Vayikach sefer habrit, vayikravos nei ha'am v'yamru, kol asher diber Hashem na'aseh v'nishma. But for a subordinate king to enter into a treaty, he's got to know what the chiyuvim are, what the stipulations were. And so therefore Moshe Rabbeinu had to read to them the sefer habrit. This idea that they have to do periodic chazara, that the subordinate king has to do periodic chazara,
on the stipulations of the treaty is evident in the mitzvah of Hakel in Tzvarim Lamed Aleph. Vaitzav Moshe otam nemor miket sheva shani v'moed shnat ha-shmita v'chag ha-sukot v'vo kol Yisrael l'ra'ot et p'nei Hashem. Oh, you see, it's a visit. When we come to Hakel, it's not just that we're coming to Bet Midash. Of course we're coming to the Bet Midash. But we're coming as a subordinate king visiting the sovereign king. And we are welcomed there. We are esteemed guests, even as we are subordinates. במקום אשר יבחר, תקרא את התורה הזאת נגד כל ישראל ומהם. הקל את העם האנשים והאנשים והטף וגרך אשר ישריך. למען ישמעו, למען ילמדו ויראו את השם אלוקיכם ושמעו לעשות כל דברי התורה הזאת. ובניהם אשר לא ידעו, ישמעו ולמדו ויראו את השם אלוקיכם כל הימים. This is important to do, Hakel. We need to do Chazara. We need to make sure the subordinate king, down to each and every last person, is aware of what the treaty obligations are. Asher atem chayim al adama, asher atem ovim et hayadim, shama l'rishna. To conclude, I want to make absolutely clear that I am not claiming here that the Torah went on a field trip to southern Turkey and copied out the treaties of the Hittite king. It just so happens that we have copies of treaties really from two places, from this Hittite kingdom from around the time of Yetziat Mitzrayim and from somewhere in Mesopotamia from the end of Bayit Rishon. But the assumption is that when you have treaties, they are by definition international. They reflect a sort of common discourse among countries and among nations. And so it could very well be that what the Hittites had, the Bnei Yisrael had without ever having heard of a Hittite. This might have just been the common parlance of nations and of states at the time of Yetziat Mitzrayim. And just as the Paitan tells us, Anu tzonecha v'ata ro'enu. If you're a shepherd, if you know sheep, you'll understand what he was talking about. If you don't know shepherds and sheep, you're going to miss something. And when the Paitan said, Anu karmecha v'ata notrenu, we are your vineyard and you are our guardsmen, if you understand that type of culture, you'll understand the inference. And if you don't, then it's Greek. And it's the same thing. When a Kadosh Baruch Hu enters into a brit with us, then we know very well that we have to do mitzvot. But what the paradigm is, what type of relationship this is, that's founded on gratitude, that it treats each and every one of us as a melech, unequal to a Kadosh Baruch Hu, but a melech nonetheless. It seems to me that by understanding brit in its original context back then, our relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu is better understood. Our avodas Hashem is that much richer. Okay. I see there's no one to pass you on the microphone. We don't need to pass me on the microphone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, Ilana, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, we do need that. Okay.
Oh, there is.
Is there? I was curious. You make the point that indicates that each and every one of us is a king. I noticed that yeah, it says, and even though most of the mitzvot, which are limited to men, it doesn't say anything explicit in the pasuk. This is almost, you know, this is one of the few, right, where it says, it doesn't say, right, for a mitzvah that's only for men. Right, if Shartan Wayot Al Yadecha doesn't say Kol Zechorcha, right? This is one of the very few that says Kol Zechorcha.
Right.
So does that mean that only the men are in the status of the subordinate king? And conversely, why does Hakel Zafka specify the Nashim and the Tas as being included?
My close friend and former colleague Ilana is right that the mitzvah of Aliyat Regel is stated explicitly for Zicharim. One way to understand that is that the status of this king is only for the men. I'm reminded of I once heard a shiur from Professor Avram Grossman, who's Chatan Pras Yisrael, great scholar of medieval Jewish history, and he told us that when he got married, he showed his wife what the Rambam says about marriage. The Rambam writes that a woman must treat her husband as a king. So he made sure to show her this, you know, during the Sheva Brachos. And so the next day, she said to him, "Your Majesty, the garbage needs to be taken out of here." So one possibility
one possibility is that truly only the men are bestowed with this status. I think one has to raise that possibility as just that, as a possibility, and it enters into the larger question of differences between men and women in the Torah and in many sources in Yahdut in general. Another possibility could simply be that it was not possible to mandate that everybody come to the Mikdash 3 times a year. They're little kids, and it's just not possible to pull off. Once in 7 years, maybe it could be pulled off. And so the obligation was only given to the men, but really all members of Am Yisrael are bestowed with this status. It's clear that the Aseret HaDibrot, for example, are said to everybody. Okay? I don't think that women are puter from Shabbos, right? Okay? So that's what I would say. Those are the two possibilities.
In terms of Aliyah, you have
wait,
to
wait,
cancel
wait.
Kana.
Just start with Rebecca. Or we can repeat your question if you want.
Why don't you come up?
Wait a minute. No, Rebecca's fine.
I'm just saying, you say that probably the women, there wasn't room for the women, maybe, but we have in Tanakh Chana, who's coming every year.
Right. So, what seems to be clear from that story in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Aleph, is that the visits of Elkanah are above and beyond the 3 times a year. It could be that this was his sort of special family pilgrimage to sort of make Chana miserable in front of everybody, and that it's not part of the Shalosh Pamim Bashana. In fact, it's pretty clear that that's the case. Okay? But yeah, or it could be that the Torah had Rachmanos on families and said, okay, only the men will go to Uman, right? If you know what I'm talking about, you know. There's no women in Uman on Rosh Hashanah, just men. and that, but if a woman wants to go, she can go, but it wasn't made obligatory. Yes?
Yeah. First of all, as for that last explanation, I think you could have given this translation of Mangrama tour on that. You wouldn't have had to put it in the text anyway.
Because you're saying it's just a practical exigency, you can't do it, so you wouldn't, it wouldn't be in the text. I'm not sure that's a good explanation. Also, in Hakel, there's an express commandment that the women should do this. So, the second thing is your whole premise of us being treated like kings. I just want to clarify that. That's based on the one text, the Hittite text, that talks about them standing, the nobleman standing up. But there's no real text that I saw in any of these sources which refers to us being standing. So what you're saying is based on that text, if that's the paradigm, the implication is that we're treated.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
I'll just add to that that in Shmuel Aleph, when in one of the early Prakim, when the Ish Elohim comes to give Tochcha to Eli for what's happening in his family, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says something like Mechavdai Achaved Ubozai Akel, something like that. Those that disregard me, I will disregard them. Those that show me kavod, I will show them kavod. So there definitely is an idea that kavod goes both ways. It's not equal amounts of kavod, but there definitely is kavod going in both directions, as an expression of a deep and intimate relationship. Okay?
In the context of the, In the context of the ancient Near Eastern paradigm, and we're saying that God obviously is the sovereign king and each individual is the vassal.
Well, each individual and also the collective. There's some balance.
I mean, it doesn't matter so much for my question. What exactly is Moshe's role? And is he God's representative or Am Yisrael's representative? And especially when he breaks the Luchot, sort of whose side is he on in breaking them? Is he breaking them on God's behalf because Am Yisrael violated the covenant, so God in some ways can cheat it? Or because Am Yisrael, as Am Yisrael's representative, Am Yisrael are not worthy of having this covenant with God and God's sovereign relationship?
Moshe plays multiple roles. Sometimes he's a representative of the people, and sometimes he's, as it were, a scribe, a sofer of the sovereign king. But it's a multiple role. And you see this, you know, when he's arguing with the Kadosh Baruch Hu after the Chet HaEgel, he's clearly not just on the Kadosh Baruch Hu side, he's on Am Yisrael's side,
there,
and it goes back and forth.
Is there an analogy of that in the ancient Near East where there's
this is what differentiates the task of Navi in the Tanakh from elsewhere. What do I mean? Beyond the fact that there's, you know, Nevi'ei Emet and Nevi'ei Sheker. In other words, that no other, as we, as Ma'aminim, so we take it that no other
quote-unquote prophets in the ancient Near East had any idea of what was really going on. But what you see is that the term Navi, when it's used elsewhere, is unilaterally a guy coming and saying, the God spoke to me and I have a message for you. It's never the other way around. Okay? Whereas Nevi'im in Israel, they jump from side to side. Sometimes they are representing a Kodesh Baruch Hu to Am Yisrael, and sometimes they're representing Am Yisrael to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. It's a big difference between Nevuah in Yisrael and elsewhere. Yes.
You've given us a fascinating understanding of the lost meaning of an ancient metaphor.
Right.
Have you thought about what would be a modern metaphor for the covenant?
No. Meaning, would you give it a try? Well, let me say this. What I have done is this. I don't think that there's a modern equivalent, which is why, in my humble opinion, this material is so valuable to help us get in touch with another aspect of our relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. What I think it does show is that a Kadosh Baruch Hu relates to us primarily as a collective unit of Am Yisrael. And this is a sense that has been lost to Am Yisrael today. In other words, many groups in Am Yisrael are quite happy to let everybody else just go off the deep end. You know, I have my shita, and I'm doing my mitzvot, and I follow my Rebbe, and this is the truth, and I have no responsibility to the rest of Klal Yisrael. There isn't even a notion of Klal Yisrael. We're doing the right thing. We define in the 17 million different ways that it's defined today by different groups of quote-unquote Yirei Shamayim. And this is a real problem. You have Jews that believe in Torah Yisrael. You have Jews that believe in Eretz Yisrael. We don't really have a movement of Jews, maybe Chabad aside, that believes in the centrality of Am Yisrael. And I think that one of the things that comes out of this is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu relates to us primarily as a collective unit. The Torah was not given to the Avot. The Torah could only be given when there was a nation. And only when the whole nation is doing what it's supposed to do is HaKadosh Baruch Hu going to be fully satisfied with us. But that seems to have been lost. As long as me and my little circle are doing what we're supposed to do, then...
So you're saying we need that.
Yes, we need that. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Beautiful.
Thank you. Okay.